This is the final chapter of the Lumpo Cha biography, and this relates to Lumpo's visits to the West in 1977 and 79, and it's called A Broader Canvas, Lumpo in the West, 1977 and 79. And the first section is called Inner Land, Outer Land. And then there's a quote from the Dhammapada that begins it. On hearing the teachings, the wise become perfectly purified, like a lake, deep, clear, and still. In 1976, Ajahn Sumedho returned to California in order to visit his parents. On his flight back to Thailand, he stopped over in London for a few days as a guest of the English Sangha Trust, a body set up to establish a Theravada Sangha in England. For the duration of his visit, Ajahn Sumedho stayed at Hampstead Vihara, a four-storied terraced house belonging to the Trust on the busy Haverstock Hill Road, a mile or so south of Hampstead Heath. The EST had suffered years of frustration and disappointment in their efforts to promote a homegrown Sangha. In Ajahn Sumedho, they saw someone who might finally turn their dreams into reality. Ajahn Sumedho's thoughts had already been turning towards the West, and he was impressed by the dedication of the members of the Trust. Following Ajahn Sumedho's return to Ubon, George Sharp, the president of the EST, flew out to Thailand in order to request Lumpo Cha's permission for Ajahn Sumedho to establish a Wat Bopong branch monastery in England. His arrival was greeted not with a red carpet, but a rush mat. Probably red as well, just a grass mat. Lungpo was still away on a journey and had instructed Ajahn Liam, his deputy, to have George sleep on the floor at the back of the Dhamma hall, eat one meal a day out of an enamel bowl, and join in the life of the monastery. On his return, Lungpo agreed to discuss the proposal, presumably satisfied that George Sharp was sincere and had more than a passing acquaintance with the virtues of humility and patience. So there's a few aspects of this. Just in general, history is somewhat subjective as according to who records the history. So I've heard Lumpo Sumedho talk many, many times about how things unfolded in terms of him coming to England and how he ended up being connected with the English Sangha Trust and then the foundation of this community. So what Ajahn Jayasaro has recorded here is mostly correct, but not according to the history as I am aware of it, since it wasn't the fact that Lumpo Sumedho was a guest of the English Sangha Trust. What had happened was that he had met with Ajahn Panyawada, who was a British bhikkhu who was a disciple of Ajahn Mahabua, and Lumpo Sumedho knew him very well. And before he'd come on this trip to the West, he'd come in contact with Ajahn Panyawada, and Ajahn Panyawada had said, well, if you're going to be in London, if you need any help, here's the phone number of this man, George Sharp. He's the chairman, not the president, of this group called the English Sangha Trust. And then you've got a small vihara, a small monastery in Hampstead, in the middle of London. And so if you need any help, call this man and he'll be able to help you out. So he had a three-day stopover in England because at that time he had been in the United States, and that the Thai International Airways didn't have a direct flight back from the US to Thailand. And so the easiest thing was for him to get a round-the-world ticket. So the hop from the east coast of the US came to London, and then it was 3 days before the London to Bangkok part of the journey was going to be made. I think that was the Thai international planes only went two or three times a week at that time. It was not sort of two flights a day like it is now. Anyway, so the Lumpo Sumedho was traveling with a layman, Pansak. And so he'd arrived in London, and what he was aiming to do was to stay at Wat Buddhapadipa in Wimbledon, southwest London. And that's what had been his plan. So he got to Wat Buddhapadipa, and then they said, oh, I'm sorry, you can't stay here. We've got this ceremony on, and all the rooms are taken, and it's impossible for you to be here. So he was a bit surprised at that, but it was very clear he couldn't stay at Wat Buddhapadipa. So he thought, aha, I've got that phone number that Ajahn Panyawado gave me, so I'll try ringing this man, George Sharp. So then he rang, and George said, yes, please come over to the Vihara. And at that time, it does accurately say, the English Sangha Trust had been established since 1956, May the 1st, 1956, it was incorporated, and had been established by an English bhikkhu, Venerable Kapilawado, with the idea of enabling the Sangha, the monastic community, Theravada monastic community, to establish itself in the UK. That had been its mission, and it had, had a few stops and a few starts along the way. Venerable Panyawado had been, Kapilawado had disrobed, but then Panyawado, his student, had stayed on for 5 years until about 1961. Then he'd gone to Thailand, and then a monk called Sangharakshita had come in the early 60s, and then he'd left. And then another monk called Ananda Bodhi had come, a Canadian monk, and he had been there for a time, and then he'd left. And in 1976, when Ajahn Sumedho came, the Vihara only had one Anagarika staying there. And there was some debate about whether it should carry on as a monastic residence, or whether the people in the committee should just have it as a lay center. So it was a bit back and forth. But during this time, George had been in regular correspondence with Ajahn Panyawado in Thailand, and had got a very clear sense of what Buddhist monastics want, particularly meditation monastics from the forest tradition. And so when Ajahn Sumedho came and met with George, and George put the word out amongst the group, oh, there's this American monk is coming, he's been a forest monk for 10 years in Thailand. And so he put the word out, and so members of the group and people who'd been involved for some time showed up at the Vihara. And they asked Ajahn Sumedho to give a talk, in which would be no surprise to most of us that it had a big impact. I think they thought the English equivalent of, wow, you know, who is this guy? Well, gosh, this chap's impressive. And so anyway, they asked him to give talks while he was there. And then at the end of the visit, then George said, well, please, can you stay? You know, at that time, 1976, Wat Phananachart in northeast Thailand, the monastery for Westerners, had only been opened a couple of years. They'd only been established in 1975 by Ajahn Sumedho. And so he said to George, well, I'm the abbot of a monastery for foreigners in Thailand. I can't possibly just sort of stay now. And besides, I'm under the guidance of my teacher, Ajahn Chah. So if you really want me to come here, then you'll need to go talk to the Ajahn. So that's why George, being the sort of character that is ready to jump in and make things happen, he said, all right. And so he got on a plane, and later that year, then went to visit Ajahn Chah. So this is the arrival of George at Wat Bopong. Again, I would say that part is accurately represented. Ajahn Chah said, don't give him any special treatment. He's come here all the way from England to invite us to start a monastery over there, to take over their Vihara, but you know, he can sleep on a grass mat at the back of the hall. So it's like if you're just sleeping in the temple on the grass mat at the back. And then see how he responds to that. If he comes across with the, don't you know who I am? Then they, okay, it's one of those. But he didn't. To his credit, he was very humble and was grateful for the welcome that he had, and was happy to sleep on the concrete and on a grass mat, and to have all his food in one single bowl. And so Lumpur Chah thought, all right, this bloke's okay. So also, maybe as a little bit of a preface, one of the things that had happened was that the communist invasions of Laos and Cambodia had happened in 1975. And so that there were these takeovers right on the borders of northeast Thailand. So there were the communist governments had come into power right next door to Ubon is in the corner of Thailand that borders both on Laos and Cambodia. So it's right in that corner. You're about, so Wat Pa Nanachat, Wat Nong Bapong are about 30 miles from the Mekong River, so about 30 miles from Laos and about 80 miles from Cambodia. So pretty close. I mean, you could hear the guns going in the distance all the time. And so there was a lot, what in Thailand was called the domino effect was being talked about a lot. The domino effect, so that Laos has gone, Cambodia has gone. Yeah. Who's next? So they thought, well, what are we going to do if Thailand, or at least Northeast Thailand, gets taken over by the communists? And what's going to happen to all these foreigners from all over the world? What do we do with them? So part of Ajahn Sumedho's trip to the States was not just to visit his parents, because he hadn't been back there for 13 years, was not just to visit his parents, but also to check out the possibilities of decamping the foreign monastic community to the USA. But the connections that he had there with the Buddhist community, they were all completely uninterested in having any monks around. They had sort of the lay Buddhist scene was growing up there, and and then people that he'd known, like Jack Cornfield and such like, said, "Nice to see you, Sumedho. Have a good trip." And there wasn't a whisper of any kind of invitation. And so when he left the state, either on the West Coast or the East Coast, and so when he left the East Coast, he thought, well, I guess we just have to make do with the best we can with Thailand, because there's nothing happening here. So it never occurred to him when he landed in England that there was any possibilities of England. He had no real, it was just a stopover to wait for 3 days to get the plane back to Thailand. So it was really a surprise to him. But the interesting thing was that during this period, George had been in regular correspondence with Venerable Panyuwado, and we have the letters that George received from him during that time. And he was sort of picking his brains, what do forest monastics really want, and what's important to you, and what are the things that are the priority? And Venerable Panyuwado had made it clear, well, that forest monastics, they're not interested in running study programs, they're not interested in writing books, they're not interested in running magazines, or even in particular teaching classes. What the forest monastic wants to do is to meditate. And so they said, if you really want a monastery to be established in the UK, then you and the rest of the group have to be ready to support the forest monastics who come, and be ready just to offer the requisites of food and lodging and support to help them support their meditation. And then if they want to teach, then they'll teach. But you should not be inviting them, expecting them to start a magazine or to publish books or to give lecture tours and such like. That's not what they're interested in. So George had a clear picture of that. And when Ajahn Sumedho arrived, and then George said, well, if you come here, we just want to support you to practice as a bhikkhu. That's all. We don't want you to edit a magazine. We don't want you to go and give university lectures. We just want to support you to be a bhikkhu. That's all. And if you are available to teach from time to time, then that's great. But we're not asking you to be a teacher. We're just asking for the opportunity to support you as a monastic to develop your practice. So the impact of that on Ajahn Sumedho was like, wow, these people are really well sussed, or the American equivalent of that. So that he was very impressed. Well, that's pretty amazing, because it was quite different from what there was talk of in the States, where people wanted to have retreats and running programs and a whole different perspective. And the fact that the English Sangha Trust, their initiative was just to support the monks to be monks. And then if something came forth from that in terms of teaching, then that was a delightful extra. So that was a bit more of the background to that.
Did Ajahn Panyuwado ever visit any of the monasteries?
He was invited back in 1974. He was translating for Ajahn Mahabua. And the hope was that he would be persuaded to stay in London, but he was so fried after his 5 years from 1957 to 61. He'd sort of done his time. He was only a junior monk, so he was same sort of age as Than Pema Silo, Than Ruchiro, Than Balado, you know. And he was running this whole place in London. And so he thought, enough. So he was committed to staying in the forest in Thailand. And some of the people in the group even hoped that Ajahn Mahabur would be persuaded to stay in England. That was a very vain hope. So he visited the Hampstead Vihara, but he'd been a monk there in the 50s. But he never came back again. And many people from that sort of earlier group from the 50s, they had a long-standing hope. People like Jane Brown or Geoffrey Beardsley and Frieda Wint and Maurice Walsh, who'd been his students, really hoped he would come back and establish a place. And there was actually a fund called the Arama Fund that was put aside to help him have a monastery and to lead a monastery if he ever came back, but he never did. So he never visited Chithurst or Amravati or any of those. So, to continue. So Lumpur Cha did not dismiss the notion of a monastery in England out of hand, but said that he would not feel comfortable about granting permission without having seen for himself the suitability of the conditions. On behalf of the English Sangha Trust, George Sharp invited him to accompany Ajahn Sumedho to England the following May, and Lumpur accepted. Lumpur set off on his first ever trip abroad and his first flight on an aeroplane on the 6th of May 1977. Accompanying him and Ajahn Sumedho were an English monk, Ajahn Kemadamo, and Tong, a lay supporter from Ubon. In honour of the special nature of the trip, Lumpur decided, for the first and only time in his life, to record his experiences in a journal. In it, he recounts that as he sat in the plane, he reflected on the Buddha's teaching that going to a strange land, in which you are unfamiliar with the language or the customs, you should not be conceited or attached to your own ways. The theme of adaptation was to recur in the journal throughout the journey. As he looked out on the billowing clouds, he developed an elaborate play on the Thai word for overseas, which is Mung Nok, which means literally the land outside, Mung Nok, comparing the land outside, inside, with the land inside, outside. It was the first of many puns and passages of wordplay that occur throughout the journal. But the first pages were also to have more dramatic content. Mid-air, one of the plane's wheels exploded. That's his first flight on a plane. So. Any of you have flying anxieties? So Lumpur's first trip on the plane. And the Thai for land outside, inside would be the land Mung Nok Nai and Mung Nai Nok, I think. But exactly how we would play on those words, I'm not sure. And so this is there are many extracts from Lumpur's journal here, and they have the original handwritten diary that preserved at Wat Bapong, and Ajahn Nyanadamo took copies of all the pages, and they did the translation together. So this is Lumpur's diary. The air staff made an announcement that we should fasten our seatbelts. People with false teeth had to take them out. People even had to take their glasses and shoes off. We had to see to our personal belongings. After the passengers had stowed everything away, everyone was silent. They were probably thinking it was the end of their life. I was thinking that this was the first time that I'd travelled abroad to do something useful for Buddhism, and was this really all the merit that I had? Once I'd thought that, then I made a vow, dedicating my life to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and settled my mind in a suitable place. I felt a lucid calm and coolness, as if nothing was happening, and rested in that place until the plane came down to make a safe landing. Passengers clapped their hands with joy at being safe. The strange thing was that when the accident occurred, various people pleaded with me, "Lumpur, protect us!" But when the danger was over and we disembarked from the plane, only one person came up to thank the monks. Everyone else went over to thank the air crew. That was the strange part. He also doesn't say here, but in his verbal accounts of it, he was, one of the things he observed was that how, as the plane was flying from Thailand, a lot of the male passengers were flirting with the air hostesses and kind of making kind of fetching remarks or kind of comments to them. And then as soon as the danger, the wheel exploded and the danger was announced, then all of that stopped. And there was this queue of people coming up to ask for him to touch him on the head and have blessings. And so that the flirtation was completely irrelevant at that point. It was just survive, survive, survive. And then in the later part of the trip, they had to land in Rome. That's where the plane stopped. Landed in Rome. And then when they took off from Rome again, then they're all flirting with the air hostesses again. So, so he had a few choice words to say about that. Like, humans, they're crazy. Yeah. Or the Northeast Thai equivalent of that kind of the people. As soon as the heavenly messengers are face to face with them, then they get serious about religion. But as soon as the Devadutas, the heavenly messengers, disappear, then they just become stupid again. So then it continues with Ajahn Jayasaro's narrative. Ajahn Sumedho's concerns about how Lungpo would react to conditions in the West were soon allayed. After the plane's emergency landing in Rome, the passengers were asked to leave the plane and board airport buses that would take them to the transit lounge. By the time the monks had disembarked, their bus was tightly packed. Many of the passengers, inevitably, were women. It was the first test of how Lungpo would cope with a new and alien world in which women did not keep a respectful distance from monks. As Ajahn Sumedho looked on, somewhat tensely, Lungpo simply put his head down and marched onto the bus, ignoring the proximity of the women. And again, as a one of the ways that Lungpo Sumedho would describe that, because in Thailand they always have a very kind of large social distance between monks and women and nuns and men. And so when they got to the bus, it was just by chance, all of the people at the top of the steps were women. And so Ajahn Sumedho was having a, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, what am I going to do, what are we going to do? And so he was having a little bit of a panic attack. And Lumpur Cha just kind of walked up the steps and just kind of maneuvered himself into the bus and said, come on, Sumedho, get on the bus, everyone's waiting. So that's part of the way that Lumpur Sumedho tells the story. It was the first test of how Lumpur would cope with a new and alien world in which women did not keep a respectful distance from the monks. As Ajahn Sumedho looked on somewhat tensely, Lumpo simply put his head down and marched onto the bus, ignoring the proximity of the women. Lumpo noted in his journal that he did not find it especially difficult to adapt his body, speech and mind to the new environment. Quote, "The unusual part was what appeared at my eyes, ears, nose, tongue and body," he wrote. "My mind was the same as normal." His initial response to what he saw around him, no doubt tinged by the reports of his Western disciples in Thailand, was of a fundamental lack. He wrote, "They have developed their country materially, but because they lack the Dhamma, they have found no contentment." On the first day in London, Lumpur was taken to see the sights, and in the afternoon went for a walk on Hampstead Heath. He was impressed by the lushness of the grass and the unfamiliarity of the trees. In the evening, he recalls, "At about 8 o'clock, 9 people came to listen to the Dhamma, some of whom had previously been to visit Wat Phapong. I taught them the Dhamma, that is, beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end. Afterwards, I answered questions with Venerable Sumedho translating my replies into English. They had prepared to chant the formal request for the 5 precepts, the first time that had occurred. After I had finished my talk, I led them in a meditation session for 30 minutes. I felt that they revealed a natural disposition with close affinities to the Dhamma." The next day, George Sharp drove Lungpo and his party to Birmingham, a city, he noted in his journal, that has branched off from London, which most people from Birmingham would not agree with. Lumpur's perception of things. Also, just talking with Lumpur Kemadamo today, he said, no, it wasn't the next day, and he didn't go sightseeing that day. I took him for a walk on Hampstead Heath myself, and he didn't go sightseeing. And we went to Birmingham on the weekend, and we arrived on a Wednesday, so it's not accurate. So again, history has got a certain subjective quality to it, that people's memories, and even possibly Lumpur's diary, he didn't record perfectly accurately what happened on which days. So there's a certain flexibility in the account. But anyway, next day, the next day, quote unquote, well, this version of the next day. George Sharp drove Lumpur and his party to Birmingham, a city, he noted in his journal, that has branched off from London, for a Visakha Puja celebration that included monks from all the Buddhist traditions, and at which Ajahn Sumedho had been invited to give a talk. And then again in Lumpur's diary. It was a day in which I saw lay people of many nationalities gather together to listen to Dhamma in many different languages. I couldn't understand any of the words they used, but I could understand their meaning by looking at their manner and gestures. But also that the group that had invited Dr. Rebuta Dhamma, who was a Burmese monk who was based in Birmingham, and it was his group that had the Visakha Puja, he'd actually been invited by a Tibetan group. It was the Karmapa Lama who had got to know Dr. Rebuta Dhamma. And when this Tibetan Buddhist group in Birmingham said, could you send a monk to lead our Buddhist center, the Karmapa had sent Dr. Rebuta Dhamma. So the Karmapa was a Kagyu monk from the Tibetan tradition, but he was friendly with Dr. Rebuta, and so he sent Dr. Rebuta Dhamma. So the Tibetans were apparently a little bit surprised when this Theravada monk arrived and said, I'm your senior monk. So at that Visakha, then it had both Tibetan monastics, including Kalu Rinpoche, and Theravada monastics. So Dr. Sadatisa was there, who was the head of the London Buddhist Vihara, as a senior Sri Lankan monk. And then Dr. Rebuta Dhamma from Burma, and then Pocha from Thailand, and then Kalu Rinpoche from Tibet, and other Tibetan monastics. So it was really quite a big array of different nationalities that, again, as Lumpur Cha said, he would never have met or heard before in his life. A few quiet days followed. At this time, Lumpur was, as yet, not widely known in Western Buddhist circles. The number of English people interested in Theravada Buddhism was still quite small, and of that number, even fewer were aware of the Thai forest tradition. Later that year, Jack Kornfield's book, Living Buddhist Masters, would be published, and the name of Ajahn Chah would become more familiar. But for the time being, he was still an obscure figure. If his trip were to have taken place 30 years later, he would have been inundated with invitations to take his daily meal in Thai restaurants, but at that time, Busabong on King's Road was the only one in London. The number of Thai residents in Britain was still in the low hundreds, rather than the 40,000 of today. The advantage of his anonymity was that Lumpur could rest quietly in the Vihara in a way that would have been difficult for him in Thailand. His next outing was a courtesy call to Wat Buddhapadipa in Wimbledon, a temple sponsored by the Thai government for the purpose of providing for the spiritual needs of Thais resident in the United Kingdom. The visit was not only a matter of protocol, it was also an opportunity to make useful contacts with the members of the Thai Sangha already living in England, to ensure their support and to request the blessings of the senior monks for the establishment of a new monastic community. It was given with good grace. The next day, the party travelled to Oxford, where they were to be the guests of the Saw family, a wealthy Burmese family who owned a large estate in the countryside a few miles to the west of the city. It gratified Lumpur that, in the morning, the monks were offered food in their bowls at the front door of the main house in a traditional manner. And from his diary it says, "It was an auspicious occasion," he wrote, "and fulfilled my vow of establishing the custom of alms round in England." In the evening, he taught the family meditation. In his diary, as in almost every daily summary, he referred to the benefit created, quote-unquote, that day. It was clear that he had little interest in sightseeing. For him, The value of his long journey was in the benefit created, quote unquote. The visit to Oakenholt gave Lumpur his first glimpse of a 10-day meditation retreat. A group of prefabricated huts, built on the estate during the Second World War, was now functioning as a retreat center. Sounds familiar? And a retreat led by John Coleman, a teacher in the Burmese Ubakin tradition, was underway. Lumpur was impressed by the obvious sincerity of the meditators. After visiting the group and speaking to the teacher, he concluded in his diary that the Buddhist lotus was starting to bloom in the West. But also to say, walking through Oxford and being told, you know, this is the Sheldonian Theatre, this is the university, you know, this is this college or that college, the university, the Bodleian Library, he was completely unimpressed with the kind of scholarship. He was interested in the stone buildings and the construction methods, but the sort of great edifice of scholarship did not impress him at all. And so that it was very interesting for those Westerners who were traveling with him that the things you would have thought a person would generally be impressed by or struck by weren't very impactful for him, but things that they didn't expect or they were surprised at would be very impressive to him. And so that apparently it was exactly the same when he was in the USA in 1979, being taken around Boston. He said, "Oh, this is MIT, and this is Harvard University," and it's kind of falling asleep in the car. And when they drove him outside of Boston, this was Jack Kornfield was taking him to Insight Meditation Society. As soon as they got out of the city and they were traveling along the road, and Massachusetts has lots of very, very big forests, and apparently he said to Jack, "Stop the car, stop the car." Jack, "Well, what's the problem?" And apparently Ajahn Chah sort of got out the car, hopped over the fence, and just went straight to the forest. And Jack thought, "Oh, maybe it's some sort of toilet emergency." And it wasn't. He kind of followed along, and it was this Lumpur kind of walking around, looking at the trees, kind of checking out the forest. And it was Lumpur saw the forest and thought, "Now that's a forest. Okay, let's go take a look." So he's falling asleep at Harvard and MIT and such like, but completely unimpressive. But the trees, wow, that was something else. So any questions, reflections, thoughts?
Did you say that you had some, as we had some letters here from Ajahn Panyavar to Lord Shah?
Mm-hmm.
Are they sort of stored in the library or?
They're actually stored in a tub in Maikuti. But when we build our fantastic new library and archive, then they'll live there. So it's quite a lot of the old letters relating to the English Sangha Trust from Ajahn Panyavar and then George, the responses to George and a bit of correspondence. I have a fat envelope waiting for the archive. So.
Lumpur Kemagamo, had he also been invited by a different group? Was there also a plan there to start this hermitage?
That's a bit of an involved story. He had been a student of Kapilavada. So Kapilavada was the original founder of the English Sangha Trust in 1956. So he was the first Westerner to receive Upasampada in Thailand, to become a monk in Thailand. So unlike Burma and Sri Lanka, where you had people from Europe coming from the early 1900s or the late 1800s, to be ordained in Sri Lanka and Burma, Thailand didn't have that, partially because it was never a British or French colony. And so that in 1956, Kapilavada was the very first Brit, or first European, to be ordained in Thailand. So he went back to London, and then the next year, 57, he took out three other disciples, Panyavada, Sadavada, and Vijayavada. So then they had four bhikkhus in Hampstead, and that was going to be the core of the Sangha in England. But within another year, three of them had disrobed, including Kapilavada, And Panyawada was the last man standing, last monk standing, or last monk sitting. And so then he, even though he was only like one vasa, one rains retreat, he was only 1 year old as a monk, he was then left being the head of the vihara. So after he'd gone to Thailand in 61, then there was Sangharakshita, and then Ananda Bodhi, and then the vihara had sort of fallen into abeyance for a little bit. And then they found Kapilavada sort of living under a different name, living a quiet life in Wales, and then the group persuaded him to reordain. So he came back and he took over the vihara again in the early 70s. So for a period of time in 71, 72, I think, then he was a bhikkhu. But by that time, his health was so bad. He had terrible arthritis and bad lungs. So his health was very, very poor. But that was the period then he was running the vihara for a second time. And so then after a period of running it as a monk, then he disrobed again and lived as a layman for a number of months, and then he died. So during that period of time, the last sort of second time he was a monk and when he was a layman there, that was when both George Sharp came along in the last few weeks of his life, and also when Ajahn Khemadamo came along. And Lumpur Khemadamo, he was an actor with the Royal Shakespeare Company. And he was a student of Kapilavada. And so part of the reason why Lumpur Khemadamo came along on that visit was because he had, had the blessing of Kapilavada when he went off to Thailand, so I'm going to go to Thailand, become a novice, and aim to go into monastic life in the forest tradition in Thailand. Then Kapilavada said, "Well, very good, you have my blessing, and you know, one day you can come back here and run the vihara." So that he had that kind of memory and that sense, that commitment that he'd made with Kapilavada, that he would so help to carry on his mission of the looking after the vihara in London. So that was part of what was behind it. So when that George had made that invitation, and Lumpur Cha was arranging to come in May of 77, then there was a number of different monks that Ajahn Sumedha could have brought with him. But Lumpur Khema was very keen because he had this connection with Hampstead Vihara before, and he knew Kapilavada, and so he was the one that then Ajahn Sumedha invited to come along with him. So it was the two of them and Lumpur Cha. So that there was a prior connection that Lumpur Khema had with the vihara that none of the others had.
Is there a record of Ajahn Panyawadu doing Pindapat? How old did he get? Was he long soon?
I don't think he went on Pindapat. I haven't seen a photograph of him around the streets of London. There's, I think, photographs of him receiving alms food at the Buddhist Society Summer School, because that was happening. That was at High Lee here in Hoddesdon in Hertfordshire, and I believe there's some old black and white photographs of him sort of walking along with his you know, robes and bowl, having been given alms food in High Lee, but not through the streets of Hampstead.
So he was fed by...
I think, yeah, people, the locals in northwest London were coming around and offering food. I don't know. It's a good question. That generation have mostly died off now. Okay, so to continue. The next section is called A Lot for a Little. Lumpur's enthusiasm for his diary continued to wax and wane, to get bigger and to get less. On a number of days, he recorded little in it but the briefest summary of his daily activities. But on the 15th of May, back in London again, he felt inspired. At about 7 o'clock this morning, sitting in a quiet, peaceful place, many insights arose in my meditation. Afterwards, I picked up my pen and paper to record them. Emerging from a, quote-unquote, a profound part of his mind, unquote, he wrote, I realized that, as a monk following in the Buddha's footsteps, there were still many matters related to the sasana that I had not yet fully accomplished, things which I was still neglecting. Firstly, concerning place. Secondly, concerning persons. And thirdly, concerning time. I reflected that truly following the teachings of the Buddha meant that, having created a sufficient amount of benefit for oneself, one should create benefit for others. It is, in fact, a somewhat puzzling passage. Lumpur's conclusion that the life of a monk is only complete when he shares his understanding with others is quite clearly one that he had held for a long time. Indeed, a few days previously he had written, quote, "One must sacrifice everything for the sasana, primarily for the benefit of sentient beings," unquote. And he goes on to say, "So, I am of the opinion that England deserves to be considered Patirupadesa, a land suitable for the propagation of Dhamma, which is why I have arranged for Western disciples to live here on a regular basis and carry on the work of the sasana. The style of teaching Dhamma here should be of doing a little and getting a lot, doing a lot and getting a little. Teaching people to see that the cool exists in the hot and the hot in the cold. The wrong lies in the right in the wrong. Pain lies in pleasure, and pleasure in pain. Progress lies in regress, and regress in progress. The little lies in the big, and the big in the little. The dirty lies in the clean, and the clean in the dirty. This is called Satchatamma, or else the science of truth, Satchasat." There's a footnote on that. The science of truth, quote-unquote, is a compound of the two Thai words, one derived from Pali and the other from Sanskrit. All of us who are disciples of the Buddha must practice in order to develop four qualities to their full extent. S-U-N-S. Supatipanno, Ujjupatipanno, Nyayapatipanno, Samichipatipanno. So those, recognize those from the chanting that we do, the four qualities of the Sangha. And then teach the Dhamma in a way true to the Buddha's intentions. We must study the science of truth and then realize the truth itself. Realization means to come to the end of the last sentence. That is what is called the One Dhamma. No more sentences of the teachings remain. It is, quote, reaching the end of the holy life, unquote, in which, in the midst of things, there is no thing. If disciples fully comprehend the Buddha's wishes in this way, then they may travel around alone, both internally and externally. Those monks are the ones who know what is what. When they know that clearly, then the knowledge of enough, the knowledge of enough emerges into their minds. When enough has emerged, then simultaneously there arise all kinds of righteousness. The Dhamma that manifests in the mind is prominent day and night. Prior assumptions about what is what and what things mean have come to an end. This Dhamma will not appear with any clarity merely through the words of another. It will only manifest through practice. It is paccatang. You can't teach it to anyone. You can't tell anyone about it. You can't study it. As the Buddha said, Akkataro Tathagata. The Tathagata, the Buddha, is merely the one who shows the way. The meaning of that phrase becomes supremely clear, free of all doubts. This is the Buddha's goal. So that's a fairly cryptic diary entry, in many respects. It's the longest passage in the whole of the diary, I believe, and that... That was only a week after he'd arrived, and he makes this comment, "This is why I have arranged for Western disciples to live here on a regular basis." So that's a week after he'd arrived. He hadn't even met all of the people in the English Sangha Trust, and he hadn't actually told Ajahn Sumedho or Ajahn Kemadhamma at that point. So they didn't know that he'd arranged that. So there was obviously a very impactful meditation he had that morning. And I'm not sure if Ajahn Jayasaro will go into it in detail, but it's significant that it was so briefly after he'd arrived that he had this sense of, yeah, these monks need to stay here, because when they came, it was supposed to be for a 2-month stay, and they all had tickets to go back to Thailand in July. That was the plan. And so that and two other bhikkhus, Ajahn Anando and Ajahn Viradhamo, they were visiting family on the east coast of the US and in Canada. They were due to fly in early July, and then the whole group, Lumpo Cha, Lumpo Somedo, Lumpo Kema, Ajahn Anando, Ajahn V, were all going to fly back. The five of them were going to fly back together. So after a week in England, Lumpo Cha had realized, no, they have to stay here, and I'll go back. And later on in July, coming up to July, Lumpo Somedo made a now famous, well, at least famous within our community, a phone call to Ajahn Anando to say, when you come to England in July, bring your long underwear. Which, yeah, and even though England can be pretty cold in the summertime, it was that was the clue that you're not going to be going back to Thailand. You know. So the next section is called Strange but Fascinating. Questions, thoughts before we continue? So, Strange but Fascinating. While he was in England, Lumpur met a number of monks from other Buddhist traditions. One of them was an English Zen monk trained in Japan called Senko. Lumpur interviewed him, quote unquote, about the teachings and the way of life of Japanese monks, a summary of which he later entered in his diary. On asking how many precepts the monks in Japan keep, he'd been told that, quote, constant mindfulness is their sila, unquote, which Lumpo found a, quote, strange but fascinating idea. He was told that there were two kinds of monk, one kind celibate, quote, these are the good kind, the ones who seek for purity, unquote, and the one kind who could marry and whose son carries on the family temple after his death. This, Lumpur noted, entailed, quote-unquote, some divergence from his own tradition. Learning that the syllable ko refers to emptiness, that evening he made it the subject of his evening talk. And this is all from Lumpur's diary. Ko means emptiness, as in the Buddha's term, temple of emptiness, sunyata vihara. We should enter into this temple. Vihara means the place where the mind dwells in the perception of emptiness. The Buddha taught that this body, in fact, all things, are empty, meaning that there is no being, there is no person. Through seeing its emptiness clearly, seeing it as merely earth, water, fire, and air, then Venerable Sumato here won't die. Why not? Because actually, there's no Sumato. Okay? Sumato's death is a convention. There is no real Sumato. There's no Sumato to die. He's not born, and he doesn't die. There's just a configuration of Dhammas, comprised of causes and conditions, which arise and then pass away. The Buddha said that the Lord of Death, in other words, death itself, can't keep up with one who dwells in the temple of emptiness. He can't find them. There is no pleasure and no pain, no self, no separation of self and other. It's empty. There is the seeing of emptiness in empty phenomena. The word empty means that there is nothing at that place. It's empty with regards to the mind. There's no conceit or view whatsoever, attaching to ideas of self, of us and them. There are simply the four elements of earth, water, fire and air arising and passing away in their natural way. That's why the Buddha said that the Lord of Death can't catch up. He can't find one dwelling in emptiness. And through that comes liberation. It's called liberation from birth, liberation from old age, liberation from death. In fact, the elements keep on being born and dying as before, but it's simply earth, water, fire, and air coming together. There's no being, no person. The mind is empty of the concept of being, empty of the concept of person. It's precisely that which is the empty place. The mind is empty in a place that is not empty. It sees the emptiness in something that is not empty. Not allowing there to be a perception of a human being where one usually arises. Not allowing there to be a creature where one is usually perceived. Not allowing the perception of death where it would usually be perceived. That's why the Buddha called it the temple of emptiness, quote unquote. If you enter it, you feel at peace, a peace free from pleasure, a peace free from pain, a peace free from birth, old age, sickness and death. That is the supreme emptiness. It's the end. So I think I was mistaken in saying that's from his diary. That must be from a recorded talk that was made from those visits in Hampstead. So has a slightly different character to it, but again, it's a very wonderful teaching of Lumpur's. And of course, it would be Ajahn Sumedho who was translating. So he's saying, so the translator is saying, you know, there is no Sumedho. So again, Lumpur Cha would very much, very consciously use the circumstance of the occasion. So having Ajahn Sumedho say, there is no Sumedho, you could imagine there'd be a very large grin on Lumpur Cha's face. There's no Sumedho. This looks like there is one. Yeah. Any questions, reflections on that? Anybody here? That which knows the person is not a person. That which knows form, the form of the body and the world, has no form. But that quality of awareness is formless, is non-personal, is... It's a quality of knowing, and so that when he says the mind is empty in a place that is not empty, so that that which knows form and people and time and things, that is that awareness is not personal. Doesn't have a form. It doesn't have a shape. That which knows masculinity or femininity is not masculine or feminine. That awareness is a non-personal quality. And if you try to think about it or to create an image, the image is again has got some form, or the words talking about it that also they have form. So the principle that Lumpur Cha is talking about here is a very regular theme of that quality, and that with the that last statement in the previous reading from Mechi Bunyu, she called the Lumpur would talk about the knowing within the knowing. So that quality of awareness, that the Puru, the one who knows, that which is aware and awake, that's why you continually speak of that as that's the refuge. So that because we identify with our body, our personality, our personal story, I am a woman, I'm a man, I'm English, I'm Sri Lankan or French or German or Norwegian, whatever. And we say this is who and what we are. And so over and over and over again, Lumpur would say, those are just the conventional truths that are determined into existence. And that this comment of this is just earth, water, fire, and air, the four elements that make up the material world, and that these can be seen as qualities of all matter, all material form. So we might say, well, there's 108 elements or 113 elements. Everyone knows that if you study chemistry. But the four elements, according to the sort of Buddhist perspective on things, is that the earth element represents solidity, or the crystal structure, the formed structure of matter. Water represents cohesion, that which holds things together. Fire represents temperature, and also the life force, the jivita, and air represents vibration. So even a physicist or a chemist will agree that matter has form, it has cohesion, it has vibration, it has temperature, and so that these are the fundamental properties of matter, so that it's not so far away from current scientific thinking as well. So that this... you can see that Lumpur was very happy to teach on quite a profound level, and that he would have recognized that this is the kind of teachings that the people are interested in and are going to be meaningful for them. And so that he would say, okay, emptiness, they're into emptiness, that's what let's go there. And then he would be gauging also as he's speaking whether people can understand, whether they're listening, they're kind of, you know, fully attentive to what he's saying, or they're just sort of like, what's he talking about? I don't know. That they're kind of confused, or it's puzzling, or that they haven't got a clue what he's on about. So he would read the group and read the body language, just like he was saying about the at the visiting the Visakha Puja, that he couldn't said I couldn't understand any of the words they used, but I could understand their meaning by looking at their manner and gestures. So he would know, you know, sort of what people were experiencing or what he was saying. And there's I don't know if Ajahn Jayasaro has it in here, but there's a very famous, again, within our community, a famous incident where he was at Insight Meditation Society and he was leading a 10-day retreat. And he was giving a Dhamma talk about Sila, and Jack Kornfield was translating for him. And that he could tell that Jack wasn't translating him accurately. That he was, so Jack would likes to sort of, he's a good friend, so he wouldn't mind me saying so. He would acknowledge it as well, that he tends to sort of steer things to a particular way that fits with his own worldview. And so, and Lumpur Cha could tell from the body language and the way people were reacting when he said something and then Jack translated it, he wasn't getting the kind of readings that he would normally get or that he would recognize. And so he turned to Jack and said, tell them that you're not translating what I'm saying. And to his credit, Jack did. But he didn't stop editing. So that was one of Lumpur Cha's great characteristics, was that he was a very, very skilled reader of people. And when people thought he was psychic, as I mentioned a couple of times, he would say, no, I'm not psychic, but you can tell everything you need to know about someone just by watching the way they walk across the room, you know, or the way they stand up or sit down. That tells you everything you need to know. You don't have to be psychic, you just have to be observant.
It's a shame they were not included in the book.
Huh?
I see, it's a shame it's
not included. Well, it might be. We haven't got to 1979 yet. It might be there. Oh. I haven't read that bit yet. We'll discover whether that's there. Mm-hmm. We'll have this sort of extended version of the other stories. Okay, well, it's just... okay, we've got... I'll read a little bit of this next section. This is called The Same Fruit.
I have a story to share. It's just about the law of death and the solid... to solidify yourself, you attach it. There's a story about a Zen. This monk, he was very... highly practitioner, and every time when he entered into the summer meditation, people cannot you can't see his soul, and so and this, because he was very highly a monk, then the king actually gave him a very precious, a valuable, nice bowl, and he loved it very much. He started to attach to that thing. He doesn't attach to anything at all, but he started to attach to that thing. And so, then come to a stage that the law of Yaman, mm-hmm. the hell, see that it's time for him to come to the hell. So he sent his lot of warden to grab fetch him. So this warden went to the temple, and because he was meditating, so the warden able to find his soul. So they asked the earth god, how to find him, they need to reach him. So the earth god told him that you can go and find his precious bow, and then you strike three times. And they did, so they look around and they found it, and they struck the bow, and he came back from his meditation. And so this warden get hold of him and say, it's time for you to go to the hell. And then he was puzzled, how are they able to locate him? Then they told him, because of your bow. And so he told them that let me say something, let me do one last thing to look at his bow. And so he looked at his bow, and then he was very upset and come to enlighten because of this attachment that he was being able trace and be taken away. So he break his bow and he ran back into his meditation, and they lost him again. Mm. So it's like saying
happy
that
ending.
The moment you attach, then they are able to trace you. It's just something that for some suddenly it come to my reflection that
be careful of attaching to things. Very good. It's a good story. Well, I see it's 7 o'clock now, so maybe we'll leave it there for today. It also reminds me of a similar story, not identical, but a similar story of a Buddha in one of his previous lives, and I think it's the one with the perfection of equanimity, the perfection of the paramita of upeka, equanimity, and so. It's a previous lifetime of the Buddha, and during that lifetime, he's this very, very stern ascetic, and so he's very, very determined, and he endures all this kind of immense painful feeling, starving himself and sitting under a waterfall with freezing water and living out in the thorn bushes in the forest. It's kind of really vigorously ascetic. Yogi who's using a lot of painful feeling, and so then with the idea that all this painful feeling is going to be developing lots and lots of spiritual spiritual benefit, and and thinking I'm going to really go for it this life. I'm a bodhisattva. I'm going to really. You're going to make the commitment to the development of equanimity, regardless of how painful and difficult and uncomfortable it is. I'll endure it without any complaint, with an even mind. And so when he passes away, he comes to the end of his life, and he thinks, "Well, I think that was a life well spent. I mean, I really tied one on there. That was really a." That was really a tough number, like, 80 years of just misery. And, I must have made some seriously good karma with that one. And so I think I really kind of did good there. And so then, similarly, then he passes away, and then to his surprise, the gates of hell appear in front of him. Like, what? Hell? How come I'm here? I was this kind of noble yogi meditating in the forest and dealing with all these privations, and so then the guardians of hell, the trusty wardens, say, "Well, yes, you did put a lot of effort in, but during all that time, you were developing a tremendous aversion to the world, to what you see, to sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch." So the result of all of that aversion during the course of your spiritual practice, all that aversion has piled up, and so you've got a stint here in the hell realms up ahead of you, and so sorry mate, you're in the lockup, and so then hearing this from the wardens of hell, he goes, "Well, so all that life, that was a total waste of time. oh well, never mind. Live and learn. And then, because he's so equanimous at the fact that he completely wasted that whole lifetime and ended up with a stint in hell ahead of him, the fact that he was so equanimous at that occurrence, then bing, suddenly the gates of hell disappear and he appears in the heavenly realm. So, yeah. That was the test of your equanimity. Was like, that was the final test. You could be having a whole kind of a long lifetime down in the hell realms ahead of you, but don't worry, you know, that one thought, like, okay, well, that was a total waste of time. Never mind. Then that was enough to rescue that. Yes, for all of us. Yeah, it's good to remember. Okay, so I'll leave it there for today.